Hei og velkommen til Salt Lederskapspodcast. Vi ønsker å hjelpe ledere I både kirke og samfunnsliv til å lede med enda større trygghet, sunnhet og effektivitet, og bidra til vekst og positiv samfunnsutvikling. Om du også ønsker å bidra ved å gi en gave etter å ha hørt denne podcasten, gå gjerne inn på salt.co og se hvordan. Tusen takk for at du hører på.
So my name is Sigurd Brekkevold, and I'm here with Scott Wilson, one of the overseers of our church. Scott, he is advising multiple organizations, dozens of organizations and churches in Europe. Scott, why don't you tell us a little bit more of what you do?
Okay, well, this is pretty bluntly, it's as you put it, traveling around most of Europe, America, a little bit of Australia, examining how organizations work, usually trying to influence a system or a process or a group of people to examine what their functions are and help them grow a little faster. I think most organizations that we work with today, generally speaking, are almost like a good, effectively powerful running car, but sometimes they just need a tune-up or a tweak, really. Organizations today aren't in a garage under a blanket and never been exposed to anything. They're highly performance engines. And you just need somebody who can come in and turn a screw and get a little more out of it, which is what I try to do, essentially.
And you have been working with us since the beginning of our journey.
Yes.
And we're very grateful for that. And you advise us when it comes to leadership. How would you define, there are multiple different definitions of the word leadership, right?
Yes.
How would you define leadership?
That's a really good question because you're quite right. There are, and actually, interestingly, with that word, you can almost make one up yourself, and it could stand in good form. So, because theorists have not, the people who study this stuff have not really been able, all of them articulated as being something different. So, in my studies and work with this, I've found three basic elements of the definition of leadership, and they include the word vision or direction. You've got to know where you're going. The second is followers, people who are coming on the journey with you for whatever reason. But if you have a vision with no followers, that's a good walk gone wrong. That's all it is. But then I think the third word is the ability to manage the two things above. A good leader will always have something in place to make sure the followers, we call it HR today, human resource, that's managing your followers. But also you've got to manage vision. So sometimes I think we have a tendency to put management aside as being administrative. It's not so important. But I think that's what makes leadership look good. So I think you'd say my definition would be a leader is somebody with a powerful vision that men and women want to follow, and they look after it in such a way that it can be sustained for a long time.
Awesome. This is a leadership podcast, and many of our listeners are not only from the church world, they're from the business world or the organizational world. And one of the challenges in leadership in a growing organization is to identify and recruit new leaders, and at the same time maintain the right culture and the right quality that you want to build. And you distinguish between building up and building down when talking about building a growing organization. Can you explain and elaborate? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, both things have to happen. But I think one of the problematic things of many organizations, they tend to run what they do. They work in a matrix system, which is that almost chaotic meeting in the hallway discussion. And you can do that where you have employees that are there for say, 40 hours a week and do a lot of matrix. But behind the scenes is always an organizational chart, usually to report what's happening up and down. But interestingly, how we often grow an organization is down by adding boxes to the organizational chart. So we add another group of ideas or concepts or departments or people, and we keep pushing it down. The top doesn't change. We just keep going down. Churches do this quite often, actually. They tend to have the top, and that's where it stops, and then add boxes down. Unfortunately, then an organization becomes a little like an overloaded Christmas tree. You know, every year you buy a new thing to hang on that Christmas tree, and by the time you get 10 years down the line, this poor Christmas tree is overweighted by all this paraphernalia we've purchased. organizations get so cluttered, filled up with stuff and things, and you have to take that Christmas tree out, shake all the stuff off and start again. My view is that actually what we should do is build up, which means, or build from up, which means that the leader who is the visionary, the CEO, the person, should be moving upwards all the time, which creates gap for others to fill. So rather than push it down, they should be thinking of, what do I not do any longer that somebody else could do? What is the one thing I do that nobody else can do? What should be my most important center of attention in terms of my time, that I, which causes me to let go a whole lot of other stuff that others can pick up? That's building up. So you don't, now you have to have your org chart that goes down, but actually you need to keep building up. And I find a lot of organizations, particularly in the mid-size range, you still have a CEO or a leader or a pastor, if you like, who's too much in the details still and not enough in the big picture, or moving up into a place of doing what they do well, which is how they started the thing in the first place, by doing what they do well. And there's an excellent book on this called, by a guy called Gerber, who wrote on what's called the E-myth. And some of you out there may well have read that book. The E-myth is the idea there's actually three stages of leadership, which is you start off as the technician, where the technician, where you start a company and you may be fixing fridges or watches or jewelry or whatever, and you create this little thing, and you're the guy who knows how to do it. Then suddenly it grows and you have to employ staff, and you become the manager, but you still sometimes have to fix things, so you go back to technician. Soon you have so many staff, you have to move to entrepreneur, or the ideas person, which is the best place to be. The creative, you're out in front, you're thinking what's next, you're dreaming, that's leadership. But when stuff goes wrong, you keep dropping down into management, and then even technician again. When you should learn, that's going down. When you should be continuing to create gap, that's going up. So hiring the right people to fill the gaps is vital in that type of structure or that type of thinking.
Coming from the business world, I recognize this. You know, this is typical for ventures and startups. You have a founder starting a company. Yeah. It grows, hires more people. But at some point in time, the founder becomes the bottleneck, right?
Yes, that's right.
He can't give away responsibility, tasks. That's right. Why is it so difficult for many people to move up and create that space, that gap that you're talking about?
That's a really good question, and I'll be a bit blunt on this one. And I think it comes down to this. I think a lot of these great leaders, they are great men and women who have created these organizations. They are very entrepreneurial. They're dreamers and thinkers. But they have a tendency sometimes to be control freaks too.
Yeah.
A lot of the leaders I work with, the issue of cutting loose is the issue of control. And they feel if they don't have control... Some of them are hyper control freaks. They just don't let go. And the worst organization to work with is one where the leader is a control freak. And that's who they are. Everyone knows it. So they let go for a while, and then they're back into the detail again. And they're right in there because they just... And that issue is psychological. It's linked to the makeup of the person. Then it is leadership. So actually they need help to get through that psychology. They need somebody who can come along and coach them out of it. They need to bring in a person ahead of them in this who's been there but broken free. So that's where smart leaders of, as you said, founding organizations with a few staff who are struggling with this, you need to get assistance, aids, helps, possibly therapy, if it goes that far, if you like. Not counseling, but therapy, to get out of it, to get that psych sorted out. Otherwise, you are the bottleneck.
Yeah, yeah. And the most difficult thing would be probably if you hire people and they are even better than yourself, right?
Threatenness.
And that can be hard for some people to recognize. Yeah. But wouldn't it be good if all the teams were comprised of people that are better, really? Why is it so threatening when people are better than you?
I think, though, if you're the founder and the owner of a company and you are not hiring people better than you, there's something wrong there because you still hold the reins of the thing. You own the shares, so to speak. Yeah. Now, what's more threatening is if I'm working for you and you bring in somebody next to me who's better than me, but you still own, that's where threatness is its worst. But if I'm the owner-founder and I bring in a hotshot who's better than me, I'm paying him a salary to do a certain thing. To be blunt, I can hire and fire as I choose there. So you shouldn't be threatened and founder in that way because you still hold the reins. But they're going to help you go further than you are now.
Mm. That's great. This is so important, the insights. So you move up in leadership as a leader, CEO, or a middle leader even. You create space for others to step up after you. But then that raises an important question. How do you identify what leaders are ready to step up?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know you have some good insights on this one, but can you give us a couple of points? Mm. How do you identify those good leaders that are ready to fill that gap?
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of things you're looking for here. Probably low maintenance people who are self-motivated are usually the ones who'll get into that gap pretty quickly. And they don't need much nudging. They are low maintenance. They don't need you patting them on the back. They don't need the praise. They're rewarded well through salary and whatever, benefits and so forth. They're self-motivated as they step into the gap. Now, there's some of those around, and they're easy to work with. Then you've got this other group that are skilled, proficient, but they're not as quite, they need a bit more work. And that's involving training, coaching, getting into their lives and helping them understand what the next level is. Sometimes it means actually confrontation, so that they, almost like the gap, if you don't fill the gap, it'll never be filled unless it's you who step in. That's a bit of a confrontation. And they have to step up. I think sometimes it's important to find out who you've got who could step up. It's just people, just by creating gap and see who fills it. And see what happens, where you're not appointing somebody to it, but you see who moves in to the gap. There's many ways of doing this. Empowerment is another way, and the process of empowering people and stuff like this helps with all of those things. So this is a big one. I don't know if we've got time to examine it totally. But look for the self-motivators, low-maintenance people. Secondly, look for those who, when you create a gap, can fill it but need a provocation to do so. And all they need is a slight nudge and they can be filling the gap.
Hmm. That's great. And often you have to actually go away a bit.
Correct. It's literally, physically.
Literally, mm. physically, mm. And see who fills the gap.
Exactly.
Yeah. Why does it work like that?
This is a great point and a good thing to observe. And in the world I work in, sometimes with let's say church organizations or para church organizations or volunteer organizations, sometimes what we've done is to help with this is create what we call a sabbatical or a break. And business people do this too, where they go away for 3 months and they're gone physically, and they have to be gone physically. They have no connections by email or phone. Very important, that one. They can't be contacted. And we send them off. Now, all the routines are managed through a book and a manual so that nothing gets dropped on the way. But what we do when they come back is very important. First, the leader, when they come back, have to come back with a report on the things they're not doing anymore. Because while you're away and you've got that space, you suddenly realize, do you know, I'm away now. I'm enjoying Miami or wherever I'm at. I don't need to do this anymore. Why am I doing this stuff? And they need to produce that list. But second, the team need to come with a list too that says, this is what we don't want you to do anymore. So the greatest moment of sabbatical or break or space is when you evaluate what took place when they came back, both from the leader and then from the team. And that's when the best gap-filling process takes place.
Mm. Wow. But that's hard for a leader, isn't it?
The control freaks find it very hard.
Yeah.
I remember we had one guy, we did this with him and his wife, and I was managing the process, and I got a phone call from one of the staff members. We don't know what to do. They've been gone a week. We're getting texts and phone calls from these people, and they keep wanting this and that. And they were on the other side of the world, by the way, on the beach doing this. And so I rang him, and I said, if you do not desist doing this and close your phone down, your email down, we're sending you a return airfare home, and you'll come home and start running what you were doing before. Of course, immediately everything got switched off. But you can see how bad it can be that even a week into the, hey, is this fixed? Is this done? Is it, you know, crazy. Not realizing that they'll never get that opportunity again in another 10 or 20 years. Yeah. Take good use of it.
We have a saying in our organization that no one is indispensable.
Yeah.
And that's even true for the top leader.
Yes.
No one is indispensable.
No. Not if you've set it up correctly and have the right measurements. Nobody's indispensable.
Yeah. And it's important for us to have language like that, sayings like that, slogans like that, because that enforces a culture where people can step up. How important is language and culture in these things?
Well, language is everything in culture, really, because I think anybody that walks into a foreign culture is a immigrant or a new person coming in. The first thing, bottom line, they have to learn is language. Otherwise, you don't really become part of the nuances of what's happening in that culture. Now, organisations are the same. If their language is fractured or different languages going on, that's called a subculture. So, and we get the ghetto mentality even to the point in organisations that you see sometimes in secular culture. There's ghettos, silo mentality. This is our area, nobody touches it. So you're constantly having to work on language that builds those opportunities for people and take it away and reframe language using slogans, referring to vision, reinforcing values, getting people to now this sounds a bit bottom shelf, but to repeat things back. And the reason you do that is so that they catch it rather than because they're stupid or not able to cope. It's about catching the spirit of the thing. So, and this is literally words we use. I have a story, actually. I'll just tell it quickly. I was in going into America and I got caught trapped in the side room because I didn't have the right things going on and they took 3 hours to process it. And it's you're with a whole lot of people that haven't got the right stuff together and I just forgot to do this. And the guy comes up and it's my turn and they're reading your passport. They take the passport away. It's quite involved. And you sort of, I want to get out of this place. And the guy walked up and he said, he just looked at me, he said, what do you do? And I said, well, I suppose you'd say I'm a leadership consultant. And I said, actually, on the pillar behind you, I see there's five values written on the pillar behind you there. And he turned around and he went through them all. And then he said this, he said, do you know, I've been here 15 years and never seen those before. And so he'd worked in that place. And one of them was customer service, which we didn't get because he didn't read it. So it just shows you that even with writing it down, putting it on the wall and putting it out, that people still never see it and get it. You have to keep doing this all the time. And you'd never let language slip. And as many places as you can get language out and it's repeated back to you, the more chance you have of instilling a culture.
And that would actually be one of the things that you would be looking for in identifying the leaders that are ready to step up,
yes,
right? If they have kind of the right language,
the right
culture, they carry kind of your tone.
Absolutely, and it's body language, it's thought language, it's relational language, it's the words that we speak. You're looking for all of those. That's when all of that comes together in one person, you've got somebody who can step up because there's synergy there. But you can meet people actually who have the right language, but they don't have the right body language sometimes. Or they have the right body language, but the language they have outside of the room is not the same. So they're leaning in, so to speak, but actually their language outside the room is not right. Mm-hmm. And that's incongruent. The word is incongruent. Congruency means everything's on the same level. Mm-hmm. When it's incongruent, it's not together, that's unhealthy. But it happens all the time in organizations because some people know how to play the game. Mm-hmm. And they play the game, but they're not right for the next level if they're just playing the game.
I hear you talk more about attitude, language, culture, more than skill or education. Kind of in Scandinavia, when we are recruiting people or hiring people for a position or a leadership position, we have the tendency to recruit and look at their CV, their education, how many years they work with this, etc. But that might not be the most important thing, would it, in a growing organization?
No. Actually, I think that equals. I think you have, if you have a job defined in writing and somebody applies and they have the skill set for it and you can see that they fulfill that, that's only half the story, in my opinion. The fact that they can do that is helpful and needy, but the second half is attitudinal stuff, or what we call the affective domain, which is the heart, the spirit, the way they carry themselves. And that requires a little bit different testing, actually, when you do an interview. It requires a lot of observation. If you're doing an interview of a new staff member, I think it's good to do it with 3 or 4 other observers who are not there to question the skill, but to watch how responses are made, maybe have questions that are actually open-ended questions that they have to answer of what they do in certain cases. And so you get the heart of the person. I think even examining what their hobbies are, what their interests are, what they do after hours is important too. Because I've seen it, and you probably have too, where their skill set matches, you put them on, but then you see on some sort of social media event, heck, that's out there. That doesn't match where we're at.
Yeah.
And this happens a lot in organisations where you don't have the right to intrude on their personal life, but their personal life says a lot about how they're going to behave with you. So I think subtly we have to measure those things to get the heart of the person too. I'd actually rather train somebody up for a role that has everything about them in heart or attitude or affective domain, because that's easier to do than get the other one.
You have to tell a story about Southwest Airlines and how they recruited pilots.
Yeah. That's a great one, isn't it? Southwest Airlines are, you know, the budget airlines that really inspired Ryanair. He's a lawyer who started this. He's not a pilot, but he saw how you could... They're just smart thinkers. So anyway, Southwestern Airlines still remains the most profitable airline in America today. Point-to-point travel, $20 a ticket, and you pay for extras, all this stuff. Ryanair model, really. Anyway, Herb Kelly, who runs this, he had two office towers joined by a connecting corridor at the top floor. So the reception was on one side of the building, and his office walked through the corridor, and his office over there. And he used to interview the pilots himself personally, as you do when you start up. He doesn't do it now, but because they've got so many pilots they have to employ. But he did. And he started to realise, you know, that actually they were just coming up to reception, walking across the corridor and showing their credentials. So he decided what he would do is meet them down in the foyer at the ground level and walk them along the path and then up to his office. But he very wisely would tip over some rubbish and some things on the path, on the ground. And as he's walking along with the pilot, and they would come in full uniform, the cap and everything, and their CV and stuff, transferring from another agency or whatever. And he'd see this rubbish, and he'd start to pick it up a little bit, and he'd see what the pilot's response was. And if they didn't help him pick up the rubbish, but just watched and almost ignored that, he never employed them. Because this is what he said, a pilot's a pilot. They're all the same. They take it up, they take it down. But there's some who will pick up rubbish as well as pilot. Those are the ones I want working for me. And I thought that's a great indication, actually, of what you're looking for. Look, a CV is a CV. A skill set's a skill set. But there's some who go a little bit further, and those are the ones you want.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
Closing in here, Scott, what advice would you give to leaders in organizations that have stagnated or stopped growing or are even declining? How can practicing this kind of leadership, gap leadership, help in turning the organization around?
Yeah, well, first of all, you've got to look at the data. You've got to find out what it is that's in slump, because other things can be moving forward and other things can be slowing down. So examine data every time, find out where the weak areas are, and then you know which to concentrate on. So you can match actually then a skill set against that, or an effective strategy actually. If it's an organization doesn't just stagnate, it stagnates often in certain areas, and other areas can be doing quite well. So you need to find out from the data where it's stagnated, and then you can write a proper strategy. Then you can find the people who can fill the gap to help you do that strategy. And then you can get things turning around. So I think it starts actually with data, strategy, and then finding people who fulfill that strategy, to be honest. It's simplistic, I know, but it is actually how it works.
Yeah, great. The simplistic is often very good.
Yeah.
Well, Scott Wilson, thank you so much. Overseer in our church, leadership consultant to a lot of different organizations and churches in Europe. Australian, actually.
Yes.
Been living now in Denmark for
22 years.
Everyone
has to live somewhere.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining us for this Leadership
pleasure.
Podcast.
Thank you very much.